What is compassionate leadership, and why is it important?
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to be here, especially with my good friends, and I'm glad that we can continue this discussion, which is, for me, it's very interesting because these themes of compassion are instrumental in terms of my own understanding and my own spiritual sort of background. And it's almost a question to me to see, can we have compassionate leadership? And is the theme of compassionate leadership something that's viable right now in this particular time? And I think the crux of it is that there needs to be kind of a shift in paradigm in terms of how we lead, you know, nations, countries, individuals, families. And I think that shift is developing an attitude and a mind of compassion. In Tibet, when we use the word compassion, and I was thinking about this today because I knew people were going to ask, what is compassion exactly? And in terms of my understanding, we use actually the term compassion meaning noble heart, and the notion of noble heart in Tibetan. And that means it is the most, the crown jewel of one's mind or heart. So that the idea of an individual, and we have a word meaning compassion, but really a lot of times people look at the word compassion and think something's weak. So if you have a weak, if you have a compassionate leader, they're a weak leader. And in my understanding, compassion is actually the strongest of a character. And so compassion is the ability or the mind of an individual to think about the needs, the suffering, and the happiness of others and those around you. When you do that, what happens to your perception, what happens to your awareness, is that you become more intelligent because you have to count, you have to kind of compensate and see what others need and where they are. That takes the focus away from yourself. And I think the shift here to me is a very basic shift. It's shifting from leaders and ourselves to a society based upon me and self, and how you can flip that and saying a society based upon intention of what another needs. And if you have that switch, then it does become, we consider it in a meditation tradition, it actually is a win-win situation. We feel better when we're compassionate, and it helps the other individual. So I think, you know, it's to me, this is a question, and the evolution of this discussion with Aquin and Erwin is that can we at this particular time see compassionate leadership as something that we would actually respect and want to encourage? So.
Noor?
Well, I would also say it's an enormous privilege to be here with three people that I feel very close to and admire tremendously. We have examples of compassionate leaders. We have actually, I'm sitting next to two right here, but we also have, and Jesus Christ, for example, led and risked and was willing to risk all, as was the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as was Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, the Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, just a few of the very well-known names of people that span thousands of years, but whose share the traits of, well, I don't have to elaborate, we don't have much time, but I think very much exemplify what Rinpoche was talking about, and a willingness to sacrifice all. Mother Teresa, for many, would also be an example of a woman who was a compassionate leader, but she articulated beautifully one of the points that Jerry is trying to get to, which is, do not wait for leaders. Do it alone.
Sorry, that's my phone. I'm embarrassed.
And if it's a leader, do not wait for leaders. Do it alone, person to person. And I think that is where. Okay, you're not concentrating, huh? Okay. But so I just wanted to bring it down to this. It's a scale of real people. Those are extraordinary individuals, but I think Mother Teresa put it in a way that we perhaps will elaborate later in this discussion. You don't have to wait for leaders. These were all ordinary human beings who did extraordinary things through their noble hearts, and each and every one of you in this room has that within you, and that's why it's a privilege to be with you today.
Erwin, can you add your point of view of compassionate leadership? Why is it important? And then maybe, if you can, if a moment, some of the tools that compassionate leaders use, and some of, I mean by tools, I mean there are skills that leaders have demonstrated over the years, such as listening and other things. And I'd like for you, Erwin, to talk a little bit about that.
Okay, first of all, so thank you for coming. This is a lot of you have been sitting from 2 o'clock to 7 o'clock, and I know I speak for everybody, we very much appreciate that you came. I thought at about 6:30 or 6 o'clock when I left the tent, I said, I wonder if only 5 people are gonna come tonight, you know, and I'll try to, kind of from the Jewish wisdom tradition. First, right now, I don't think compassionate leadership is a choice anymore. And I'm going to define compassion a little bit differently, or kind of another way of thinking about it. Right now, with the amount of power individual people can have to hurt other people, which really is relatively new at this level, we simply can't wait to have only heroes be compassionate leaders. And I think that the Queen's point that all of these heroes were at one point ordinary people is really, really critical. So the first thing I want to say is that compassion is actually a practice. It's not a noun. It's not like, poof, I have compassion. We think in nouns, but it's actually a verb. What we're always doing or not is compassioning. And one compassions, but you hear it as a verb, and you got to get it in there as a verb. As one compassions, one becomes better at compassioning. That's the only way to do it. So you have to practice it. It's not like you're just a nice person who happen to be compassionate. So that's one thing. Second thing is the misunderstandings of compassion, and Rinpoche, you know, began to talk about that, is that compassion is not weakness, compassion is not justification, compassion is not saying it's everything okay, you can do anything you want. That's not what compassion is. I want to offer this as an understanding of compassion. It's actually the most difficult in some ways and fiercest type of judgment you can make. Compassion is, think of it this way. You come home at the end of the day and you've had it was a bad day. And you get home, and because your mind has not been practiced in compassion, that bad day is kind of percolating inside of you. And you come home, I'll just give you an example for me. I come home, and I go right to the mail, and my wife of 25 years, Dana, turns to me and says, "Why are you going to the mail first thing? How about saying hello?" Which actually, there's nothing wrong with that. She's kind of right. And I lash out. Right? I lash out. Now, what compassion is from her, and then we have a fight, and it deteriorates. Until actually, because we have worked on this, what compassion is let's hear the whole story. If we genuinely, right, could judge the situation, really judge the situation, or I would say give justice to the situation, because that's one of the real problems, that compassion and justice are separated. That's a disaster. Okay? All compassion is it's genuine justice. Okay? If I could really give justice to a situation and the genuine interdependence and the cause-effect of every single thing, then I would, first of all, Dana would look at me, and the second it came out of my mouth, what she would know is, oh, bad day. Because I'm exactly doing that's it. I couldn't do anything else at that moment. And she would judge it with compassion, which of course would do what to me? Would begin to evoke in me, and that I think is when Rinpoche says, what about you? You know, your needs, your happiness, that's beautiful. Your needs, your suffering, your happiness. My needs were, you know, I needed to be healed from the day. My suffering was, you know, somebody really hassled me. And my happiness actually would come from my wife, right, completely, and vice versa. Now, all that means is that compassion is the strictest, fiercest form of justice. Okay? And I think that we need to begin to think about it. We need to think about it that way, as a verb, as a practice, and actually not as weakness, but as the fiercest form of justice itself. And in a world as violent as this is, and I'll conclude with this, it may be that compassion at the evolutionary stage is at the highest, and one after 14 billion years, we're going to need a lot more people at the highest evolutionary stage. We have a reptilian brain that lashes out. We have a kind of limbic brain that, you know, loves to connect, but only to our own, and our own tribe, and our own children. And then we have a kind of a neocortex, next level of evolution, in which we really are compassionate to all beings. For most of history, very few people got there. The stakes are very high for many of us getting there now.
She gave me the single.
I thought it was interesting the fact that there was a man and a woman in your story, and I think and the way you were describing the reality of humankind today is not entirely inaccurate. But I think that was slightly tilted towards the male kind of description.
And compassion.
And I only raise this in the context of the qualities that women are increasingly demonstrating in the world today, that they are bringing to leadership and compassioning in parts of the world that range from Africa to the former Yugoslavia to far the Far East to the Middle East and Latin America. I've worked with women in all these places who, because they emphasize cooperation over competition, because they emphasize consensus building rather than egocentric, if you will. Decision making, multitasking, working across boundaries, finding common ground, especially in conflict situations, with women from Tutsis and Hutus in Rwanda, Serbs, Croats, and Bosniaks, and many examples around the world. Women do bring, I think, and are able to set an example, and that's the reason why in many of these conflict regions, women leaders were elected after war, because they were symbols of unity, they were symbols of people in touch with people on the ground, and of the kind of change that they felt was needed in these countries. So we have some hopeful examples, and excuse me for monopolizing the
conversation.
It's
actually very appropriate, no. Thank you for that.
Nora's done a great job of talking about some of the different skills that women and men can bring to a situation. I'd like to take it further and ask Rinpoche, to talk about some of the tools of leadership. I mean, we know a lot of leaders in the world use fear as a tool to control, to gain support. And I would argue that there may be other tools, such as trust, but Rinpoche, what could you add to that?
Well, I took on, I know to some of you I don't look very old, but I took on responsibility at a very young age. And, I used to think about my responsibility in terms of what I had to do. And my teachers used to always tell me to develop compassion and certain ways of developing compassion. And so some of these great masters, I remember one great master who was actually, his name is Dingo Chenzin Rinpoche, and he's the teacher to the Dalai Lama as well. And he was a great grandfather of Tibetan Buddhism. He'd often wear no shirt and had very long hair, so a few times we were on the airplane and people mistake him for a woman sitting in their
chair.
Sorry? And a lot of times, I think, with the teachers, they would tell me that compassion, if you want to do anything, you have to have a base of compassion, whether it's a spiritual thing or whether it's a sort of an everyday kind of thing. And I used to think in the beginning that, in terms of the whole effort of compassion, I used to think, in terms of like Buddhism, I wanted to get to the teachings of more advanced teachings of Tantra and these kinds of things. So we would sit for hours and listen about compassion, and we'd go, get over with it, and get to the main thing. And at a certain point, I realized the notion of compassion is something that is essential and is something somebody has learned over the generations. And for myself, when I meditate or develop compassion, because I thought somehow you just have compassion. It doesn't just kind of, it doesn't, you think you're just going to appear. But it's a state of mind or an ability, and you have to kind of develop it and develop it further. And the other aspect of compassion is that they say compassion comes in a kind of a trio. They say you have to have wisdom, courage, and compassion. Compassion is not just by itself. And so the ability for compassion here is that it is something, a lot of people say, you have to have compassion, you have to have love. Where is it that we spend time developing compassion and love? So as in a leadership position, sometimes we are told to do that. In terms of my personal understanding is that you spend time developing that attitude. And really, you come out of your own bubble, and that's what compassion is. When you come out of your own psychological bubble, then you see what's going on. It's a very natural extension. See what others need, what others have, and then that's a natural response. So in terms of tools, it's an essential tool, because if you can't feel what another is feeling, how can you respond? And in order to do that, you have to have a mind or a brain that can detect that, and that's what the notion of compassion is. And then you need courage in order to act on it. So I feel like right now we have a lot of people who are inspirationally compassionate, but we don't have enough courage. And so that courage kind of blocks us off. And I think as we, in a very basic way, when we get up, we think about ourselves because we're not courageous about compassion or something else, especially in this particular time when there's a lot of speed that takes us away from this kind of activity.
That's great. Let me ask you I'd like to ask you to sort of do it.
I don't.
Seriously, I mean, listen, what he's talking about, requires listening and an openness to ideas, or maybe a tolerance of others' ideas, right?
That's exactly what I wanted to follow up on practices of that, because I think that what Rinpoche is saying needs to be heard really, really seriously. It's not that you can just go love. You just can't, it's not like go be compassionate. You really have to practice it. Here are things that here's, at least from my tradition, something of things that you can do. And that one is, you have to create a distance between the reactive response when someone hurts you. But it doesn't make a difference if it's in your family or you're a leader or you're a president or in my tradition, even if you're the anthropomorphic God who lashes out and is very destructive, because God doesn't have it all together, in at least in Jewish wisdom tradition. So even God needs some meditation moments. So you have to create some distance. And here's a way to do it. Practice thinking of somebody who's hurt you and create a story that evokes in you compassion for the person that's hurt you. Because there's always a larger context. There's always a wider story. There's always a perspective of interdependence in which it's not that the person's not responsible. It has to do with our reaction to what happened. And so think of somebody who's hurt you, right? Your natural response is either fight or flight. And right now, unfortunately, it's mostly fight.
Or smote, right?
Smote. Yeah, right? Fight, flight, smote. And actually construct a story. Don't even have to do anything yet. Just train your mind. Construct a story that would evoke understanding. That's one. Second is the people closest to you. Try once a day giving a benefit of the doubt, because a benefit of the doubt is constructing a larger story without doing all that work. Because sometimes it's very hard to construct the whole story. Who has the time? But if you constructed the whole story, you understand? If you constructed the whole story, if you could see the cosmic perspective, if you could see from the balcony, which is what the single most important quality of a leader is, vision. Vision just means how high do I see, or how much do I see, or how clearly do I see, that's not distorted by my own reactive response, which is always has to do with me. It doesn't have to do with the other person, because all quick reaction is simply an internal self-judgment. It has nothing to do with the other person, even if the other person is objectively problematic. The only reason you're seeing it and the only reason you're reacting is because it's an internal thing. So, close person, benefit of the doubt. Third, and I think right now, this is really important when we have ideological battles. Learn a piece of the truth of some other side that you most deeply disagree with. It's great practice. It's like, I'm a liberal, but I try every so often to try, what is the partial truth of a conservative view? Because no one is so smart that they can be 100% wrong. It's not possible to be so smart. And by the way, and as a Jew, I'll say that's including Hitler. And until one can understand the partial truth, not your tolerance thing, but it's more than tolerance, the partial truth of that which we most deeply disagree, what happens is one inevitably has to be violent with the whole person. And this is it's not so hard to do. Just read once a week, read something by someone you know you're going to deeply disagree. I'll tell you this last experience on this. I read the president of Iran's speech to the UN, okay? Now, I'm nervous by him. He wants to destroy the state of Israel. That's not good for me as a tribal Jew. And I'm proud of being a tribal Jew when I'm a tribal Jew. So I start out with a certain amount of, you know, hostility. And by the way, I do believe there's compassion and hostility. That's another thing. It's not, it is, because compassioning is wherever you are. So you can kill with compassion. I'm not a pacifist. You can kill with compassion. And every tradition has that, right? And that's better than killing without compassion. That means you have to kill and then cry. I'm not kidding. Let me just this last thing with Ahmadinejad. You read the speech, and it's very scary and very enlightening, because half the speech, if Iran disappeared tomorrow, disappeared from the face of the earth tomorrow, half the speech is an accurate critique of specifically the United States. And we can, and if it's only 30%, that's fine too. And if it's only 20%, that's fine. And that partial truth needs to be located. And that's how, that is what compassion is. It's, what is that person thinking? What is that person doing? How did that person get to where they are? It's simply a fancy word for understanding.
And the avenue towards common ground, if you ever want to resolve these problems rather than continue to.
Yeah. Right, I mean, it's the only way.
Isn't compassion also the idea that, hey, we all sort of belong here, okay? So is compassion, and have you guys got a comment that the idea that compassion also has to recognize that people who have different ideas need to be here in some way? Isn't that why we went to war in Bosnia, that, you know, to stop? A lot of the wars today are in places where some group doesn't want the other group to be there.
Well, I think it's what we're talking about here is that compassion by itself doesn't work. You need strength, you need intelligence, and that kind of practice or meditation or just putting yourself in another situation, even that exercise, evokes. I mean, the thing is that most of us, when you just ask the question, what do you want for another person? Do you want them to be miserable? You know, of course we're not going to say. We say we want them to be happy. We don't want them to suffer. And that's basically the attitude. But a lot of times that gets hidden. And I think what we're talking about here is that to put ourselves in a state of mind where we can at least entertain the, you know, ability of what the other person is doing. And once you do that, you think of why they are doing that, what your response has been. So it's not so much, I think, in this kind of situation, trying to smother it with kind of compassion, but you're trying to actually look at the situation. And a lot of times, you know, the thing is that as I feel like as you are more compassionate, you become more intelligent. Because a lot of times, if you do your compassion and you don't do it right, and you yourself become the fool, then you learn from that experience. And I think in this situation, clearly, the world is a very complicated place. But what tools or what method are we going to use now as the world gets more diverse to understand the variety of what's going on? We have to have even more compassion, which means understanding more what is going on. And that will result in what? More answers in terms of what's going on. And then we have to decide what answer that is.
That's really interesting, because the Jewish wisdom word for compassion is rachamim, which is translated as womb. You know, womb, like, you know what I mean? And so that means that the compassion actually generates a new worldview. Mm-hmm. It generates new ideas. And if you watch a lot of what happened today in the tent, a lot of what happened today at the tent was at the very, 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 very best of externalizing. And that's why almost every session left without any, they were the best at political, economic, sociological analysis, the best, most articulate people. But it was from the same consciousness that produced all the problems that we have. And that's why they always left us kind of like off, and then the person had to do some kind of, but we have a lot of hope. And what we're, no, that's, I really mean, I don't mean it in a not nice way. It was a fascinating thing to watch. And what Rinpoche is saying is that, no, there's this other level of understanding that changes. It literally generates new solutions, but you can't do it until you get there.
Yeah, let's talk about compassion as a strategy. If you don't mind, Noor, I'd like to ask you,
Nor several months ago went down to Colombia to negotiate on behalf of the UN, and I won't say that. Why don't you explain the story a little bit about meeting the rebel leader in the jungle and why you went and what was the strategy behind it?
I told you I didn't want to tell this story, but I that's the nature of our friendship. At the request of the president of Colombia a few years ago, I did make a trip down to the country, indicated that I, at his request, that I would meet with Marulanda, the FARC guerrilla leader, in his headquarters in the jungle, in Colombia, and try. The president had tried every avenue, and the UN, and diplomats based in the country, and so many others around the world, to find some kind of political common ground with the FARC, who have been maintaining themselves as a guerrilla movement that began with legitimate social concerns and grievances, having been forced out of a democratic political process, which they entered in a democratic fashion decades before, by landowners and others with vested interests, and they had been done quite violently. So they had a legitimate cause at the outset, but they've stagnated and maintained themselves somewhat the way some of the PLO did over many, many years, just as guerrillas for the sake of being oppositional to the state, and watching their own, not aware of, but their own people suffering, the people who were their raison d'etre, their justification for their actions, and supporting themselves by kidnappings, by the drug trade, and also using young children as soldiers and as those sent out, as so many evil armies do in this world today, in the forefront of battle, to be the ones who step on the landmines or who are the first casualties of any conflict. So I agreed to try to then negotiate a series of humanitarian accords that maybe could lay the ground for a dialogue that then could perhaps lead to a more political understanding. And the focus being child soldiers, the focus being their use of landmines, which continues to this day. It's a horrific toll on civilians and children, schoolyards, targets that have nothing to do with their cause, and the kidnappings. And I tried, just to make this story a little bit shorter, very hard to appeal to this guerrilla leader who's aging. Must be in his 70s at least by now. What kind of legacy did he want to leave? Mm-hmm. That I had witnessed in the Middle East, for example, Yitzhak Rabin in Israel, King Hussein of Jordan, and others who had been through untold violent and destructive historic periods, and had come to realize that this wasn't the legacy they wanted to leave for their children. Militant forces in Northern Ireland, once they began to have children, their own families began to realize this wasn't the legacy they wanted to leave for their children. And I tried to appeal to what I felt would be his human, what we all consider to be somewhat universal, human aspiration to leave a legacy of something better, more hopeful and constructive.
That's wonderful.
One of the reasons I didn't want to share the story is because it wasn't a success. And it continues even to this day, this tragic situation.
But the point you just made about a legacy, I think, is a key thing for leaders. I mean, Erwin mentioned vision. A leader must have vision. But I think, is it also true, you think, Rinpoche, that leaders and decision makers, and this goes to all of us as individuals, should think about our legacy when we're about to do something, when we're about to use our power, when we're about to enter into a negotiation? Do compassionate leaders think about the legacy of that event
what they're doing. And Erwin, maybe afterward you can I can ask you, is this as strong as the need for revenge, or is revenge also a legacy people want to lead? But first you.
Well, I mean, I think what Queen said right at the end in terms of it wasn't a success in terms of what she expressed, which is interesting because I feel like in the practice of compassion, it doesn't really matter what happens. It's like the success is, in a sense, I would like to think of it as more subjective than objective. It's not, because if we keep thinking of objective, if I say, I'm nice to so-and-so, but so-and-so wasn't nice to me, I'm not going to be compassionate anymore, the whole thing starts falling apart. So there has to be an internal conviction that this is actually the right thing to do, which clearly you have and are doing. And so it's that determination. And if you have that, whether it's emotional understanding of compassion or intellectual understanding of compassion, and you say, this is the best way to resolve these issues. And the thing also is, in terms of strategy, I feel like it's sustainable. That seems to be the key word these days. How can you sustain something? Because if you're continuously trying to use aggression or trickery and things like that, you're having to, it's a very high maintenance situation. And so, you know, compassion here is sort of like, you know, we think it's harder, but in the long term, it's better. Whereas aggression at this point always seems to be like the best solution in the short term, but then all of a sudden you find yourself in that situation again. So it's a matter of what kind of way are you going about it. And I think it relates personally too, because I know for myself, if I based my compassion practice based upon what kind of feedback I got all the time, my practice would be long gone.
Yeah, I want to agree. I think that first I want to say to Queen, these are long processes, so you have actually no idea what you left behind. And I think that that's part of, that's the thing about violence that seems to be so appealing is it, in the very short term, looks like it works because you blow up that person, and that person's dead. And so it looks like you've accomplished something. But of course, all you've done is added more resentment, grievance, etc., and not only to the other person, but you've created a habitual pattern that's very hard to break. I mean, that's what we're seeing in between the Israelis and Palestinians. It's not a moral justification. It's just the trauma is so great right now that the storyline is act to act. There's no storyline anymore. It is simply act, react, react, act.
Generation.
And it's not even an interesting story anymore. Mm-hmm. It's nothing. It's because it's so short term. So long term are these processes in which people are constantly widening and widening the frame and the lens. And I think there's another important point here is that some of these things in the world need interventions. They are not going to be, you're not going to be, because people simply get it. And there are going to be interventions by the outside. So it takes a lot of courage to actually drop into Colombia and into the jungles and try to make it do an intervention. And I think what we haven't done is we have invested a lot in war. And sometimes war is necessary, but it's always necessary only to make peace so that you can create the space to actually address the issues that caused the war. And if you don't make war to make peace, then the war continues. So these interventions, we haven't invested in compassion studies. We haven't invested in how compassion actually becomes habitual. And I mean habitual in a kind of practiced sense. If you think about, and I'll use Israel as an example, the United States government gives $3 billion to Israel. But all $3 billion goes to arms. Now, I'm not taking a position on that, but it seems that and it gives about $10 million to peace relationships. That's a little off. $3 billion to $10 million, and we should have a little what we'd call compassion strategy investment. And last thing is that I don't know how we got to the point where we think war and violence is a more realistic option than compassion. It's so strange, because for all of human history, war and violence hasn't worked. So you would think that if you were a deep realist, not an idealist, I'm not an idealist, I don't even know what that means, because it's very subjective. If you were a serious, 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 cold-hearted realist, you'd say, well, this isn't working. Let's try something else.
That's great. We're getting a little late on time, so what I'd like to do is ask each of the panelists, just before we get to questions, we'll have a little time for questions, each of the panelists sort of share a story of their experience of compassion in their
in their lifetimes that they've experienced. And Noor, I know you know what I'm going to ask you, so wait to the end, please. And I'd like Rinpoche, if you could start off with, you know, okay, something that you've personally experienced or through one of your teachers. I mean, one of the things that's great is the Dalai Lama, you know, says, hey, the Chinese are our teachers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what could be more compassionate.
Yes, in terms of what Owen was saying, it's the way I like to think about it, because people often put compassion into a spiritual category, you know, and this kind of thing. So it's not realistic. It's not practical. And one thing I always like to joke about is that, you know, one thing is like, we have a long tradition in Tibet of people meditating, and I was saying, you know, do you think that meditation and compassion has lasted for 2,000 years because it didn't work? Like, you have one person saying, I sat in a cave for 50 years, and by the way, I want to tell you it didn't work, so I want to tell the next person, come here, you know. Let me tell you something that really doesn't work, so you can, you know, waste another 50 years doing it. And, you know, it's like, you know, these people are, and I always like to think, you know, like, you know, we were just talking the other day saying Tibetan Jews are very kind of similar, and in that they're very practical people, and they only do things that work, and especially when you're living at 14,000 feet. So, you eat what's healthy and you meditate on what works. And the notion of compassion here is that it's the answer and it's the response. And, you know, His Holiness has talked about the Chinese being the teacher in this situation, and I had the opportunity to go back to Tibet, and I was allowed to go back, and I remember meeting with many people, and when I met with them, you know, they were crying, and a lot of these people had been tortured, and, you know, a lot of you, I'm sure, know that probably 1.2 million Tibetans were killed during the communist invasion, and a lot of them were, like, there would be lamas, and they're monks, and the monks were told to kill the lama with a gun and all these kinds of things. There's a lot of, and people were tortured and all kinds of ways. And so when I went, I met with a few of the elder village leaders who came to me, and at a private moment, I expected them to, in that private moment, to tell me their bitterness, and that would have been okay in that situation. And I was struck by how there was no bitterness. And at a certain point, it's sort of like the Mandela kind of story, he said, we had a choice of what to take. And we realized if we had taken that choice of aggression, it would have poisoned us, and we would have all died. And so we chose compassion. And you can tell in terms of their physical manifestation of how they were, that's what allowed them to survive, to the point now that you know, the communists have tried to eradicate the cultural and spiritual background, but I think it is the compassion that has survived that has allowed things to blossom. So, you know, and that's a very kind of, you know, kind of tangible experience.
So, Erwin, can you?
I'll tell you, for me, the most powerful story of compassion that really shaped the way I think about, for me, the most important conflict in the world that affects me, which is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it's a man by the name of Yitzhak Frankenthal, who in 1999, his son was hitchhiking and got into a car, and it happened to be that three terrorists were in the car, and they killed him. And Frankenthal he tells this story, and I mean, I heard this story, he told the story to me. He was sitting shiva. Shiva is this, you know, you take 7 days and you kind of grieve, and whatever, okay, so you take 7 days and grieve. And in the third day, one of his friends, and by the way, Frankenthal is a traditionally observant Jew, okay? That makes the story more important here. And his friend comes over to him and says, and quote, this is Frankenthal, this is not me, he says, now you see why we have to kill those Palestinian bastards. And Frankenthal got like, the word bastard in Hebrew, the word bastard at the moment of Shiva, like, it didn't go together. Do you know what I mean? Because here he was mourning his son, and he made a decision at that moment that he was going to locate Palestinian parents of children who had been killed, collateral damage, all the words that different communities use to avoid whatever the responsibilities are that have nothing to do with the external world but the subjective world. Okay, is that safe for those people so they don't get killed? Okay, and he began to locate them, and one Palestinian parent after another, and he founded an organization that's actually Israeli and Palestinian parents of children who've died in this conflict.
It's not the Forgiveness Project, is
it? No, it's another, this is a little earlier. The Forgiveness Project is an important project. But here's this guy, and he simply said that standing at the grave of your child, right, standing at the grave of your child makes you either compassionate or a vengeful. And that, and it's the same, in some ways it's the same story. That's the choice. And I want to say this is an important lesson from this story is that anger can make us compassionate, but it generally doesn't. It turns out that suffering, more often than not, makes us compassionate. And that means people with power have to make sure that they get in touch, even when they think they're justified in using their power. It becomes very important to get in touch with people who are suffering. I know I tell in my community, you're a hawk? Okay, you want to kill every Palestinian? Okay, I mean, I'm not into you and I don't want you to come to my home, but I get it. I said, it's very important for you to learn the name of a child that dies in collateral damage who's 2 years old. Because that two-year-old is not a terrorist, even by your own definitions. So you got to learn the name and just think about a little bit the suffering of those parents. Not the terrorist, because suffering does evoke compassion.
Thank you, Irwin. Nora?
One of the most extraordinary examples of compassionate leadership, and I was privileged to see many in the years that I shared with my husband, but one that I shared at the event that we were together last fall with the Dalai Lama, exemplified his understanding in his heart and in every aspect of his life of actually a fundamental principle that is the heart of all of our faiths, anyone in this room, certainly the Abrahamic faiths, but every faith ascribes to the golden rule, the principle of reciprocity. One of the best statements of it, I think, is the Judaic scholar Hillel, who said, who articulated the principle, whatever is hateful to you, do not do to another. That is the whole Torah, he said. And basically, I think that applies to all our faiths. But my husband, in response to a Jordanian soldier during a time of high tension in our region, though that's no justification, but a Jordanian soldier, after the peace treaty between Jordan and Israel, there was an area between the two countries that started to become a passageway, and on this occasion it was for some young Israeli schoolgirls, who this soldier, in a deranged moment, shot at and killed, I think, seven young girls. And my King Hussein's instinct was immediately we were actually traveling to return home, and the next day to helicopter into Israel to condole the families of these young girls who were all part of, I think, one village. And as he entered each home, he found the families in the traditional Jewish form of grief, which is sitting low, and he knelt down in front of every of the parents of these young girls. Now, going helicoptering into Israel during that particular moment politically even was somewhat problematic in and of itself, but kneeling down in front of these families, which he didn't have to do. I mean, it would have made a wonderful gesture in any fashion, but kneeling down in front of these parents was something that he knew inside would horrify the Arab world and draw vicious condemnation for a whole range of reasons. But it didn't, he didn't think twice about it, and it was heart to heart. It was courageous, but more than that, and more than the compassion, it was an exemplification of his faith in every human being and his feeling that the parent grief of these parents was his grief. And it had an extraordinary impact in Israel. And you know, we'd heard a little bit before, and later we heard that if Israelis could only have King Hussein as their leader. And it wasn't just for that reason, but there were the hardened, the more hardline, less intuitively or instinctively compassionate segments of the society were completely transformed, if you will, by that simple act. And that was, you know, one example of a compassionate leader that I didn't mention in the leaders I mentioned at the outset, but certainly for me is up there with them. And I would just like to leave with the thought that, is there anyone you can think of who's more powerful, who's had a more powerful impact than those people that I mentioned at the outset? Then, you know, the messages of Jesus Christ, of the Prophet Muhammad, of Mahatma Gandhi, even Martin Luther King, the Dalai Lama, Nelson, the impact, and as you said, the long-term building impact of their messages. I don't know any greater power that we have had.
That's lovely, thank you. Well, we have time for just one or two questions. You please.
But you said, and then you can cry afterwards. But it just struck me the wrong way. It just didn't resonate with everything else and some of the wonderful things you said.
I just want to correct it so you understand, because I shouldn't have said it, because it's very complicated. I don't dualize things. It's not peace, war, compassion. That's not how it works. All these things are interdependent. And if we begin to think that there's this thing war here and this thing peace here, what we'll have is we'll have warmongers who are peaceniks and people who think that all war is about peace. So what I'm suggesting is, because everything is fundamentally subjective, not objective, everything, wherever you are, right, is where you can be more compassionate from. Now, me, I'm not going to war, okay? And you may be so evolved that you would never go to war. But there are people for whom war is, for them, the highest level where they are. So what I want from them is to do that at a higher level than people who would do it at a lower level. And that's what I mean. And if we can get everybody moving wherever they are more compassionate. And my tradition has this story. We go out of Egypt, and the Egyptians die in the sea. That's the biblical story, and there's a wonderful telling that the Israelites are actually very happy because their enemies who have oppressed them for 400 years are dead, and they're singing a song, and the God character in the story says, "What are you singing about? My creatures have died." Now it turns out at that moment of evolution there was no alternative but that. But given that, you need to cry. Now, I happen to think that is a... is that the ultimate evolution of where we are? No. But if the expectation is everybody is going to jump from a kind of reactive war, reptilian, reactive response all the way to be kind of pacifists at the highest level, the pacifists are going to wind up getting killed.
When you answered that question, the one that you're asking about, I was thinking in my mind, I wonder if waging war for peace, which mm-hmm. is what you mm-hmm. actually said there, whether that is going to be something, and call me naive, but I'm thinking it's going to be less and less possible because
Absolutely.
Of this the world that we're living in, the increasingly networked, interdependent world with so many more voices, including women's voices, but so many more voices
Absolutely.
Now influencing affairs. I think that may be
you.
Something that is
you.
Less and less likely.
Comment on that?
Not really, but.
you, sir?
You don't have to evolve past it.
Yeah.
Rinpoche.
Okay.
We both look.
Okay, I'll try.
Very compassionate statement.
Yeah. I'm trying to be compassionate to you for asking that question. I think that, I mean, that's part of why we're doing this, is that we've somehow, through the process of a leader having to have power and self-preservation is what makes a leader. And we think that's the characters of a leader, and I think we're trying to change that fundamental image. Now, I know, like, in my history, like, there was the King Ashoka of India. He was a warmongering person. At a certain point, he says, this does not work. He's a historical figure. And then he changed his attitude and said, compassion works better. He started a whole dynasty which, you know, created the state of India at this point. So there's been cases of individuals who have, in a sense, been warmongering people. And then when they look at it in cold fact, they're saying, if I want to rule over this country, it's gonna self-destruct under myself. And I think in the case of Russia and these other places, if you see people who are trying to be strong and warmongering, how long is that society going to last? It's a very unstable society, because at the head of it is unstable. So all of a sudden, the activity is unstable, and all of a sudden, the economy is unstable. And from that point of view, if you have a stable intention, then you have a stable result. So I think from kind of what we're talking about is this shift. And there are clearly going to be leaders who are going to be aggressive, but we're saying, ultimately, that doesn't work. And that's kind of what, you know, the situation we're in.
Anyone else?
Okay.
All
right,
this gentleman.
Your Majesty, Moshe, mm-hmm. Rabbi, unique opportunity to have the three of you here. I'd like to ask a unique question. Several years ago, my mother passed away, and I didn't get to ask her this question. And one of my teachers, I did get to ask her this question. She was in her 90s. What's the one most important thing you could pass along to me? If you were on your deathbed, you had only one idea you could share with someone else, what's the one most important thing you'd like to share?
Queen?
Yeah.
You always have a ready answer.
I have one.
Good.
Okay.
I'll be back. That's what I would say.
Thank you all very much. It's been a delightful evening. I think we've done it.
Great.
Thank you.